storm right now is over the far western Bering Sea to the northwest of Shemya.
The massive Bering Sea storm loses steam as it hits land. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Republican Mike Chenault gets ready to become Alaska's longest-serving House Speaker.
We will wait until it's determined who our next governor is going to be. Then we will have those conversations about what direction the state should go.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
After a lengthy 4 days to select a jury, opening statements were made this morning in the murder trial of Leroy Dick Jr. at the courthouse in Dillingham. Dick is charged with first-degree murder for the killing of unarmed village public safety officer Thomas Madole in Manicotick in 2013. In his opening statement, State Prosecutor Greg Olson described the scene after the murder as investigators collected evidence, including the spent .223 shell casings outside of Dick's home in the village.
They recovered shell casings in various locations. There were, six shell casings closer to the front door of the house, and then one final shell case next to BPSO Madole's body.
Olson said an autopsy showed Madole had several gunshot wounds to the lower portion of his body and one gunshot wound to the head. In his opening statement, defense attorney Lars Johnson told the jurors the state would not be able to prove that Leroy Dick had intended to kill Officer Madole, which is the substance of a first-degree murder charge.
Leroy killed Officer Madole. We're not going to argue otherwise. That's the reality of the situation. But it takes more than that for the state to ask you to convict him of first-degree murder. It takes that intent to cause the death.
Jurors heard testimony this morning from the Manicotick health aide who had called Officer Madole to respond to the scene, then warned him about going there alone. Also called to testify was State Trooper Victor A., a BPSO support trooper who spent that morning with Tom Madole in Manicotick and had flown back to Dillingham only moments before Madole was shot and killed. The state presented evidence until 3 o'clock today. The trial is expected to resume Monday morning. After a week of warnings, a heavy-duty storm washed into the Bering Sea early this morning. Hurricane-force winds smacked the far western Aleutian Islands, and while the storm has disturbed life at sea, it's expected to start losing power fast. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
As the storm made its way into the Bering Sea on Friday morning, it became clear that it wouldn't be entering the record books. Joe Wegman is a meteorologist for the National Weather Service. He says the low pressure system isn't strong enough to take the title of lowest ever, but it is packing a punch.
The storm right now is over the far western Bering Sea to the northwest of Shemya. It's reaching about its peak intensity right now. From this point forward, it's going to be very slowly weakening.
That's because weather fronts are breaking off from the low pressure system and hitting individual islands like Shemya. It's a small outpost in the western Aleutians with just a few military instruments and contractors. Gusting winds reached 96 miles per hour there on Friday morning. That kind of activity could continue.
Each time a front comes through, you can have a short-term increase in the winds with gusts that could get even higher, and they always are accompanied by a wind shift.
A shift in direction, that is. Every front takes a little bit out of the storm, including the one that's just hitting Adak this evening. City Manager Leighton Lockett is watching it build.
It was calm this morning, which would have been really nice for the rest of the day. But sadly, it has increased in wind. So we've seen, I think, peak at about 49 so far. You know, we're really not seeing anything outside the ordinary of a nasty, kind of gloomy day. But other than that, life goes on right now.
The same goes for Unalaska. While moderately gusty winds are expected overnight, the skies were calm and sunny on Friday morning. It would have been a good day for the Cornelia Marie to finish up their Red King crab season, but instead they were tied up at the dock in Unalaska, and engineer Travis Laughlin was fixing a damaged crane.
If this wasn't going on, I should be down in Key West racing from the offshore powerboat world championships is what I should be doing right now. Yeah, unfortunately, it doesn't always go as planned, and here we are still in Dutch.
Like a lot of fishing crews, they opted not to take their chances on the water. Captain Wes Swimmelaar has been fishing for 35 years, and in that time, he's worked in seas as rough as those projected to hit the Central Bering Sea over the weekend. But crab isn't a derby anymore. With no time crunch, Swimmelaar and the crew of the Barber J decided to go back to port in St. Paul.
We probably could go charging back right out to the grounds as soon as we're done unloading and get our asses kicked today, tonight, tomorrow, and everything would be fine. But I'm not going to. I'm going to go to the north side of the island and put my anchor out and just sit there for about 36 hours and then go fishing.
Cargo ships were also taking steps to get out of the storm's path. Brett Farrell tracks those vessels for the Marine Exchange of Alaska. And for most container ships,
they've gone much farther north after going through Unimak Pass. And then what I'm also seeing is a lot of cargo vessels just kind of stopped and loitering and piling up around the Shumagin Islands off the Alaska Peninsula.
They're not bunched around shore, though. Farrell says vessels have to stay 12 miles off the coastline as part of a new regulatory program implemented this year. More than 1,800 cargo vessels have signed up to cut their risk of an oil spill rather than meet a new Coast Guard regulation. That would force them to have fast access to spill response equipment anywhere in the state.
And that's virtually impossible to meet for the entire coastline of Alaska, just because of the vast distances that we're talking about in the remote areas, and it would require response hubs out in places where there's no infrastructure whatsoever.
In a way, the storm is the first big test of this new alternative program for cutting risk. If vessels meander too close to shore, Farrell says they'll get a stiff warning. Until then, ships will spend the rest of the weekend doing something they're used to in the Bering Sea, wishing for better weather. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal with help from Annie Ropeek.
Early next year, Alaskans will be able to legally buy, transport, and use small amounts of marijuana. The initiative will not be law until 3 months after the vote is certified, and the state has additional time to come up with rules for marijuana sales. In the meantime, there are still many questions about how legal marijuana would work in rural Alaska. Municipalities have the option to ban the sale of marijuana, but they can't restrict transportation or possession. The campaign to oppose marijuana had its base in rural Alaska and named ACIAC's Mike Williams as its chairman. He says he's disappointed in the results.
The villages need to take a look at what they can do at the local level, at the tribal level, and to continue to pursue making sure that our communities are healthy.
Many questions remain on the law enforcement aspect of legal marijuana, but it's clear that Alaska's large rivers remain under federal law, which prohibits marijuana. Chief Petty Officer Kip Wadlow, a Coast Guard spokesman, says his agency's crews are responsible for federal navigable waterways, including the transportation corridors of the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers.
You know, they are federal law enforcement officers, so if they encountered person or persons who are in violation of federal drug laws, we do have the authority as law enforcement officers to seize the illegal drug and possibly take that person into custody depending on the amount and what the situation was.
The Coast Guard would follow up with other law enforcement. Wadlow emphasizes that the Coast Guard's other top concern is making sure people are not boating under the influence of drugs or alcohol. The law doesn't restrict employers' ability to outlaw drug use. Williams says that's a tool that may expand in the coming months.
Maybe it would be time for mandatory drug testing to all of the employees in schools and community organizations.
Bethel voters were split on the vote to legalize the possession and use of marijuana, with 52% voting against legalization and 48% for the ballot measure. It passed statewide with those percentages flipped, 52% for and 48% against. The Alaska Miners Association annual convention has been going on all week in Anchorage. Coinciding with the AMA's 75th year is the 25th anniversary of Kotzebue's Red Dog Mine. The success of Red Dog did not come easy, according to NANA Regional Corporation CEO Maureen Green, who was today's keynote speaker. Green said NANA is uniquely positioned to meet development needs of the future.
Northwest Alaska has many of the minerals that the world will need in the future, and the world is looking north. Climate change, open ocean shipping routes, potential existing mineral development, and offshore oil and gas exploration and development are drawing global attention.
Green says it all began with Red Dog, the mine developed in partnership with Teck Cominco. But getting the mine started was a long, difficult process. When mining giant Cominco found zinc in the region in 1980, there was opposition to a large-scale mine. Lawsuits and countersuits followed, but Alaska Native land claims under new federal legislation enabled NANA to select the lands where the mine is now located. Since its start in 1989, Red Dog Mine has provided $1 billion in proceeds to NANA, $608 million to other regional corporations, and $199 million to shareholders. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a surgeon operates with a robot to relieve intense pain.
It feels like your insides are like Play-Doh and somebody's digging their fingernails into it. It hurts so bad.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Nikiski Republican Mike Chenault will serve his fourth term as House Speaker in the Alaska State Legislature. That will make him the longest-serving speaker in legislative history. At a press conference today, Chenault stressed that advancing the development of a gas line is a major goal for the Republican majority in the House. He also said he would be willing to work with unaffiliated candidate Bill Walker should Walker's lead in the governor's race hold.
No one wants to be adversarial to start with. I think that what we will do is we will wait until it's determined who our next governor is going to be. Then we will have those conversations about what direction the state should go.
Chenault and Walker have in the past disagreed on where a gas line should end, what stake the state should have in it, and if the state should pursue the development of a smaller diameter bullet line as a backup plan should a deal to build a bigger line fall apart. Chenault also said the state of the budget will be driving a lot of the legislature's work this spring. With the price of oil down substantially, a major revenue shortfall is expected. Chenault said a draw from savings is likely, and the majority may have to win over some support from the small Democratic minority to get the votes necessary to tap the constitutional budget reserve.
If that happens to be the case, and we end up in a position because of the price of a barrel of oil or because of the revenue stream, and we've got to go to the CBR, then we'll negotiate with the minority on what it's going to take to be able to fund the Alaska's budget.
The Democratic minorities in the House and Senate have also selected their leaders. Anchorage Democrat Berta Gartner will lead the Senate majority.
We are happy to work with anybody on any issue, whether they're in our caucus or not in our caucus.
Democrat Berta Gartner will lead the Senate minority. Anchorage Democrat Chris Tuck will again lead the House Minority Caucus. The University of Alaska Board of Regents has passed a budget for next year, but there's concern about state funding. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Regents meeting in Fairbanks approved a $971 million operating budget. That includes a $395.7 million request from the state. Legislators funded the university at $373 million this year, a level that, combined with rising fixed costs, resulted in $26 million in cuts. University President Pat Gamble told Regents to expect another shortfall.
All you got to do is look at the price of oil and the fact that we haven't come out yet with what the revenue prediction is.
The price of oil has dropped about $30 a barrel in recent months, setting the state up for a major revenue dip if the trend persists. This is the time of year when the state crunches budget numbers, and Gamble pointed to an additional complication this fall, the undecided race for governor between incumbent Sean Parnell and challenger Bill Walker.
And the two potential governors both have different views of how they want to treat the university. We've got quotes from both of them. The one thing that's common in both cases is they've got big bills to pay, and the university is one of the biggest, and they're going to look very carefully at how much money they're going to give the university. We then have to look very carefully at where are we going to put those fewer and fewer dollars.
Gamble said the budget problems come as some university programs are showing success, pointing to positive testimony heard by Regents this week about culinary, health and safety, engineering, and mining programs. Gamble warned that a third straight year of budget cuts raises questions about program sustainability.
How many years can we try to overcome $25 million in a row? How many years can we do that in a row and finally just run out of things to be able to find the dollars for?
Regents meet for a budget retreat in January to discuss long-term funding issues. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
There's no timeline for reopening the $24 million Bethel pool, which closed right after the grand opening this past Saturday due to a sprinkler system issue. Acting City Manager Pete Williams says the city wants to have experts look at the system in light of the recent devastating fire at the new alcohol treatment center.
As we speak, they are trying to determine what the problem is, and until they really can determine what it is and what's needed to, for the fix, it's kind of hard to give a timeline on when it'll be open again.
Doug Cobb works for ProDev, the project management firm, and is in Bethel trying to figure out the issue.
We have pressure at the hydrant, and there's something inconsistent in the building. We have got the system to work successfully several times, but to pass the test, that needs to be done over and over and over. That's what we're troubleshooting.
The state fire marshal granted the city an exception last Saturday to host the grand opening, even though inspectors the day before found the pressure to run the sprinkler system to be inadequate. Cobb says a fire sprinkler specialist from the lower 48 has been consulted. The Alaska Marine Highway System will no longer allow children and teenagers under 18 to travel solo. The current rules place no restrictions on 16 and 17-year-olds. Solo travelers 12 to 15 need a note from a parent or guardian. Kids under 12 must travel with an adult, but it could be anyone. Spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the new rules focus on safety.
We're on large ships, we're on open ocean. If they're unsupervised, different accidents could happen, especially if we're in rough weather as well.
The new rules say anyone under 18 must travel with an adult, and that adult must be a parent, legal guardian, or have notarized authorization from a parent or guardian. Minors traveling as part of chaperoned youth groups, such as school sports teams, are exempt. So are teens who are married or legally emancipated. Woodrow says there's a reason for requiring permission slips to be notarized.
There has been instances where runaways have been aboard the ferry system, and this prevents a 15 or 16-year-old from forging their parents' signature and saying, yes, they're allowed aboard.
He says the rules will also help protect children from being assaulted or abused while on a ferry. The policies will be enforced beginning November 20th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, high-tech surgery.
Surgeons these days have a lot of futuristic tools at their disposal in the operating room. They use robots, high-definition cameras, and special dyes to help them complete complicated procedures. And you don't have to travel to big cities in the lower 48 to find the most up-to-date technology. APRN's Annie Feit suited up for a surgery at Alaska Regional Hospital in Anchorage to see how it works.
Miranda Studstill is 24 years old, and for the past 2 years, she's been in near constant pain.
It's just like a searing, stabbing pain. It feels like somebody's just like, your insides are like Play-Doh and somebody's digging their fingernails into it. It hurts so bad.
Miranda has endometriosis, a disorder where tissue that usually lines the inside of the uterus grows outside of it instead. And lately, her life has been dictated by the disease. She's endured 3 surgeries so far. And when I meet her for the first time in a doctor's office in East Anchorage, she's preparing for surgery number 4.
Okay, so chronic pelvic pain, endometriosis, but more on the right side than the left side. Okay.
Her surgeon, Dr. Donna Chester, lays out the plan for the next morning. She's going to remove Miranda's right ovary and any endometriosis she sees. She's hoping that will relieve her pain.
Okay, so laparoscopy. 4 incisions like we've done before. Go inside with the robot.
Less than 24 hours later, Miranda is under anesthesia on an operating table at Alaska Regional. It's hard to even see her under the mound of sterile blue drapes. And Dr. Chester is not standing over her. She's 10 feet away, sitting at a console that looks like a high-tech video game. The robot is called a Da Vinci. Chester's hands are on 2 controls that manipulate robotic instruments inside Studstill. TV screens illuminate what the cameras attached to those instruments are capturing. As Chester moves the controls, the instruments respond, snipping tissue apart that is stuck together. They're called adhesions, and they can be very painful for patients like Miranda. But Chester doesn't see much else near the right ovary that's cause for concern. She pops up from the console.
Since all that pain was because of that adhesion, I can leave that ovary in. I mean, she's only 23. I hate to take an ovary out if there's not a... Okay.
To make sure she's not missing anything, Dr. Chester uses a new technology called Firefly. It's a bright green chemical dye that will light up any endometriosis Chester can't see with the robotic cameras. She even lets me have a look.
There we go.
Wow. So what is the green is just showing you?
It's a dye that goes in there, and any area that there's endometriosis is supposed to be more hypervascular and supposed to show it up more. I'm not seeing any additional stuff in here, which is good for her. So all she had were the adhesions. Okay. And if it's only adhesions, that's so much better.
Chester goes out to the waiting room to check in with Miranda's mom and then comes back to close up the 4 small incisions. She does that the old-fashioned way, without a robot. She's pleased with how the surgery went.
I think she'll feel the pain difference almost immediately when she wakes up.
As for Miranda, she was thrilled to be able to keep her right ovary.
When I woke up in the recovery room, that was the first thing my mom said is that you still have it, and I'd started crying. It was really, really awesome.
I met with Miranda less than 2 weeks after the surgery. She had already started back at her job as a court reporter, and her pain was a lot better too.
It's still kind of there, but it's so much better. It's not the first thing on my mind now.
She says she's eager to get her life back.
I'm really hoping that it'll change everything. The last 2 years, my life has really been on hold because I've been so sick and it's been so difficult. It's had a huge impact on my social life, on my working life. I haven't been able to work as many hours as I wanted to.
And Miranda's hoping it's the last surgery she'll have to go through for a long while. For AK, I'm Annie Feit.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Kivalina on the Chukchi Sea.
Stanley Hawley, I'm the tribal administrator for the native village of Kivalina. I've lived here almost all of my life, 52 years. Kivalina is a Russian name. It got tagged with a Russian explorer, I think, who came across in a sailboat and was checking out new territories. Our village is on the sand spit. There's a Kivalina Lagoon on the northeast side. It's got 2 channels on both ends, and then the Chukchi Sea on the southwest side. and it has a rich history. At one time, the village was abandoned due to starvation, but then people were traveling back and forth, and the northern villages for their subsistence activities. And instead of going all the way back home from wherever they came from, Notak, Kotzebue, and Sisamorath, and even the upriver Kobuk villages, they stopped in Kivalina and decided to resettle it. The reason we live here is because it's real rich in natural resources. Further inland, there's lots of lead and zinc offering work. The Red Dog Mine is developing the lead and zinc deposits. Our pending projects are, we're building an evacuation road to the mainland, and then at the terminal of that road, we'll build a whole new school. The best part of living here is our community. We're a community-oriented people.
Stanley Hawley is the tribal administrator for the city of Kivalina. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ashley Snyder and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.